Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Good evening, everyone. We've got a little official business to do here. I've got a gavel, and this is, of course, a Commonwealth Club meeting. So welcome to the Commonwealth Club and to this meeting. You can find the Commonwealth Club online at commonwealthclub.com, also on Facebook and Twitter, and also on our YouTube channel. So tonight's program is part of the club's Good Lit series, sponsored by the Bernard Osher Foundation. I am Mark Leno, your termed out state senator, and your moderator for the program tonight. We are all in for a very special treat. If you are not familiar with Cleve Jones's irreverence and wit, intelligence, passion, and soulful commitment to social justice, environmental justice, economic justice, and criminal justice reform, you soon will be. Cleve is, of course, a human rights activist, lifelong human rights activist, organizer of Unite Here, and author of the new memoir, When We Rise, Stitching a Revolution. Cleve, of course, joined the gay liberation movement in the early 70s when he was just 3 years old. He was mentored, as we all know, by Harvey Milk through his early races before Harvey first won in 1977. And then as a student intern, Cleve worked in Harvey's City Hall office until the day of the assassination. Subsequent to that, Cleve co-founded the San Francisco AIDS Foundation. In 1983 and 1987, he founded the NAMES Project AIDS Memorial Quilt, and it is now one of the largest community arts projects in the entire world. Cleve was portrayed by Emil Hirsch in the film Milk, Gus Van Zandt's Oscar-winning film, and also served as the historical consultant for the production. In 2009, Cleve led the National Equality March in Washington, D.C. He also served on the advisory board of the American Foundation for Equal Rights, and you may remember that that was the group that was formed to challenge the constitutionality of Proposition 8, which went to the Supreme Court. And in 2016, ABC aired a miniseries partially inspired by Cleve's memoir, When We Rise. Now, not all of us in life are as fortunate as Cleve Jones and Samuel Johnson to have his own James Boswell, but he does. And that is good fortune because as all of us make our way through life, how wonderful to be able to have a hand in writing some of that history, especially when some of that history includes us. And Cleve had that opportunity in becoming very close friends with Lance Black, who you may know won the Academy Award for writing the screenplay for Milk. And I've gotten to know Lance as well. He came to Sacramento to testify for our Harvey Milk Day bill, legislation that we moved a few years back. And Cleve, you may remember, he had his own telling of your introduction and all that he has learned from you at a Harvey Milk Club annual dinner, in which he said he's learned so much from Cleve. He learned all of the history of Harvey Milk, only some of which he knew. He learned about the movement, he learned about the quilt, and he even learned that Cleve Jones invented gay sex.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
So I'm going to conclude my remarks just by sharing this with you and with Cleve. There's no one in this room, I think there are few in the entire city, who have not been touched by the HIV AIDS epidemic and the virus itself. I'm very fortunate to have made the way through the epidemic as someone negative. But my partner, Doug Jackson, died in 1990. His 23-year-old brother came to live with us in 1985. He was getting progressively more ill. He was on the East Coast. His friends couldn't care for him. We had an extra bedroom and bath and, of course, the best medical care in the world. And so young Stuart came to live with us. That was December of 1985. Stuart was dead by the first week of March of 86. So beginning of the epidemic, we had just identified the virus, and that is a life-changing experience for anybody. And then subsequently, Doug and I got tested. We found out he was positive, and a few years later, he got sick and then died in June of 1990. But I share all this with you because, for whatever reasons, as I was going through all this, I sort of retracted, and I didn't really get involved with the community's grief and despair through the epidemic. Yes, I was on boards of directors and raised some money to do my part in fighting the epidemic, but otherwise I kept my own personal story pretty close to myself. But weeks before Doug died, there was the annual march around Harvey's birthday, candlelight, and it had become incorporated with HIV Memorial. And of course, it was at the time, just a few years after the first idea of the quilt panels went up. And Doug had very lovingly, as a brother, done a panel for his brother Stuart and carried it to Washington, D.C. for the first exhibit on the mall. And then when Doug was dying, of course, I knew I wanted to do a quilt. I didn't know what I was going to do, a quilt panel. In any case, I went to City Hall that night, and I was in a crowd of lit candles and a whole community. And my heart just melted that night. And Cleve, I just want to share with you the power, the personal power of that experience of being a part of a family. Yes, we were all grieving, and the quilt panels were transformative for all of us. And it sewed us together as well as the panels themselves. So for that, I am personally very indebted. And I want everyone to please welcome our guest tonight, Cleve Jones. One second.
Oh.
I don't think I... We are now in order. All right. You're going to speak here or in the chair?
I'm going to speak here first, and then I'm going to sit down. And I'm going to be relatively brief, briefer than I usually am, because I want to make sure we have room for questions and comments from all of you. So be thinking what your smart questions are. I'm very glad you're running for mayor, Mark, and I'm very glad that I work for a labor union that makes endorsements, and therefore I can't make endorsements until they do. So it gets me off the hook for a while, but you've been a good friend to me for a long time, and I'm glad you're running, and I think you'll be the... You have a civility and a willingness to listen to people that I admire enormously. Even when you disagree with them, you always give folks the time for that, and I appreciate that greatly, and you've always given me the time. You've responded to my calls, and I think I look forward to this campaign. I want to say a little bit about my book and where I'm at right now. I begin my book and end it with the statement that the movement saved my life, and that's not hyperbole. And those of you who have seen the miniseries or already read the book, I grew up at a time when really there was no public discussion of homosexuality at all. This was long before Ellen DeGeneres and Will and Grace and same-sex couples with their families at the Easter egg roll in the White House lawn. You know, there was no discussion of it at all. And for younger people, I think it's sometimes difficult to imagine just how much silence there was around the issue. And if you ever did hear anything about it, what you heard is that we were mentally ill and criminals. And in California, we were not decriminalized actually until 1976. And as late as 1976, over 2,000 gay men were being arrested in this liberal town for consenting sexual behavior between adults. And every police department in this country had special divisions whose sole function was to entrap and arrest and imprison gay men. So that was the world that I came out in. And You know, I thought my life was over before it even began. When I was 15 years old, both my parents had surgeries. My mom had her gallbladder out. My father had spinal surgery. There were a lot of pills in the house, a lot of pain meds and sleeping meds, and I began to steal them one by one because I was certain that at some point I would be discovered, and then the only solution I could imagine was to take my own life. So I began to steal these pills and hide them away until I had quite the stockpile. And then in 1971, I was hiding out in my high school library reading Life magazine and pretending I had a lung disease so I didn't have to go to gym class where I got beat up. And I'm hiding there in the library. And you, those of you who are older remember Life magazine. It was large. And you could hide behind those pages. So I was hiding out in the library and flipped the page and I see this headline that says Homosexuals in Revolt. And then there was this 10-page article about the new gay liberation movement and all these photographs of these hot, long-haired guys with their fists in the air fighting the police in Greenwich Village and Los Angeles and San Francisco. And, you know, that was the moment when I decided, no, I'm not going to kill myself. And I flushed the pills down the toilet and I survived high school and I stuck out my thumb and I came to San Francisco. And, you know, I got here and I was an idiot white child from Scottsdale on the streets of the Tenderloin. And it was a pretty grim existence. I know what it's like to be hungry. I know what it's like to be homeless. I know what it's like to do things you don't want to do to survive. But I was fortunate in that I was mentored and assisted by an enormous number of people. And some of them are celebrated, women like Del Martin and Phyllis Lyon, who started the Daughters of Bilitis. Jim Foster, the first gay person to speak at a major political party convention. He spoke at the Democratic Convention in 1972. I think at 3 in the morning. And of course, Harvey Milk. And when I first met Harvey, I didn't really take him seriously. He was just kind of one of those neighborhood characters. And I don't know which neighborhood you all live in, but I'm sure you have a neighborhood character that you all know and love. And so Harvey was that kind of person. But when I met him, he still had the ponytail, and he seemed a little old to be a hippie to me. But I liked him, and he bribed me with an internship. He wanted me to go back to school. He knew I was reluctant to leave Castro Street, but he got me to go to school at State in the Urban Studies program, and I got an internship there. And then when he won his election, finally, he ran many times before he won, and then he took me with him to City Hall, and I had the amazing good luck to work with Harvey Milk. And earn 8 credits until November 27th, 1978. And when I saw his body, I remember, just the shock of it. I'd never seen a dead person before. But all I could think was, it's over. It's all over now. We were kind of trapped in the office for several hours while they bundled up the bodies, and we played the tape that he had left because he predicted his assassination. And through that whole thing, I just kept thinking, it's over. It's all over. You know, he was my mentor. He was quite a father figure to me, and he was one of our leaders. And I just thought, now it's over. And then the sun went down, and the people began to gather. Gay and straight, young and old, black and brown and white, immigrant and native born from every neighborhood and all around the Bay Area. And we began that long, silent march from Castro Street down to Civic Center Plaza. I'm sure you've seen the footage. And I remember standing in Civic Center, surrounded by that lake of candles, and realizing it wasn't over. It was just beginning. And a few months later, you know, we marched again after the verdict came out. And we didn't carry candles that night. We carried torches and used them. And out of the aftermath of the riot and being called up for a grand jury investigation, I got the most awesome job working for the speaker, Leo McCarthy, in the state assembly. And he, for the young people here, I'm not offering that as career guidance, but Leo McCarthy hired me and assigned me to the Assembly Health Committee. And I didn't know anything about public health issues, so I subscribed to all of the various journals, including the Morbidity and Mortality Weekly report out of Centers for Disease Control. And it was there in June of 1981 that I read that first paragraph about this new disease that was killing gay men. They were dying of Kaposi's sarcoma and pneumocystis pneumonia. And I clipped it out and I stuck it on the bulletin board. And then 1 month later, the New York Times ran their first story about, I think, 41 gay men who had died. That was the summer of 1981. By the fall of 1985, almost everyone I knew was dead, dying, or home caring for someone who was dying. And I thought again, well, now it's over. How do we move forward? This is the worst possible thing that could happen to us, and now it's over. But we acted up, we sewed quilts, we marched, we got arrested, we confronted the government, we confronted the pharmaceutical industry, and as gay men died, lesbian women stepped forward and took over the leadership of our organizations that were being decimated by the disease. They ran the blood drives to collect blood donations to support their brothers. It brought the community and it brought the community together and tested the community in a way that was really unimaginable. I did not get sick until 1993, and then I got really sick, and I thought it was over. I began to lose my vision. I couldn't walk unassisted. I was wasting away. I moved out of the city into a little cabin in the Redwoods up in Sonoma County, and I thought, I'm done now. It's over. And then ACT UP stormed the FDA and the NIH and relaxed the protocol for the clinical trials. And I got access to that very first cocktail, which, by the way, is a slander and a slur against vodka tonics. I took those pills, and they were very toxic, had unpleasant side effects, but within a very short amount of time, just literally weeks, I became stronger. And I was able to go shopping for the first time. And I saw my friend in the Guerneville Safeway. His name was Jeff, and he'd been in the very same clinical trial I got into. And I looked at him, and he looked good. He looked strong and healthy. And I said, "You look good, Jeff." And he said, "You look better, too. And maybe we're not going to die." I said, "Maybe not." Then he said, "But we'll never be happy again." And I said, "No. You know, how could we ever be happy again after what we've seen and what we've lost?" And the years have gone by, and I've gotten stronger and healthier, and I've continued to fight, and I joined the union, and have, for the last 15 years, been working primarily within the labor movement, which connects me to, you know, the struggles of real, you know, working class people in this country. Our union is mostly immigrants, mostly women. Think of the women that clean the downtown hotels. That's our union. And then this past November, and I have a boyfriend. He's younger than me, and so we text a lot. And I'm sitting alone in my apartment in the Castro watching the election results come in, and the first loss, and I text him, you know, "It's over now." And he says, "No, honey, it's not. Hold on." And then Florida went, and I texted him, "It's over now." He said, "No, honey, she's going to pull it together. Well, she'll win." And then Pennsylvania goes, and I can't text anymore. I called him. I start ranting at him, and he listens patiently. And after a couple minutes, he cut me off, and he said, "Honey, you just went from zero to Auschwitz in 3 minutes." You know, get out of the apartment, go down to Castro Street, meet your friends, and start the march. And we got down to Castro Street, and there were dozens, and then there were hundreds, and then there were thousands, and then there were tens of thousands, gay and straight and young and old and black and brown and white and immigrant and native born. And we marched and marched, and I thought, no, it isn't over. And so I am 62 years old. I am healthy. I am happy. I am in love. I am waiting for the results from the Georgia special election. And if anybody's got them, just speak up. But it's not over. It's not over. We're going to keep on fighting. So let's do this. And if you've got any questions, bring them up. Thank you.
All right, so we are collecting cards so we can begin the Q&A part of our evening.
You'll edit the rude ones?
Maybe.
Yeah, maybe not. Is there any word from Georgia yet?
Yeah, it's got 4 points.
Which way?
For her. All right. So slightly distracted, but the first question is that many educated, well-meaning folks think the struggle is over now that we can marry. We know that's not true. What would you say to them?
Well, it's not true, and it wasn't true even without a Trump victory. There are so many states where it is still perfectly legal to discriminate against gay and trans people. We still have an awful lot of young people that are taking their own lives, which, as I contemplated in my teenage years, and that's something that hasn't changed and that we still need to fight for. But now with the Trump election, we have to really be very aware that the Republicans hold all three branches of the federal government. He is going to be packing all of the federal courts. They control two-thirds of the state legislatures, so we're going to see more and more of these licenses to discriminate. So absolutely, the struggle is not over.
And I'm just going to add a little bit to that myself.
Please.
In that because of all the noise that is so distracting to the entire country right now, there is a bill pending in the House that, of course, will go nowhere with the current majority. Not a new idea. It has to do with equal protection under the law, which is already in our Constitution. But few Americans recognize that in a majority of states, there are no legal protections from discrimination based on sexual orientation or gender identity at all. Mm-hmm. So we can be denied a hotel room, denied housing, denied employment, denied
medical treatment.
And this is the state of this country. It is horribly backward. And so enormous amounts of work to be done, but it cannot happen state by state, and it will not happen state by state. We need federal protections. And so the new bill, rather the old bill being the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, just focusing on employment, now will add sexual orientation and gender identity to the 1964 Civil Rights Act. And it does have the full support of the Black Caucus in Washington.
One of the reasons I love my union so much is that we're actually the only union in the private sector that is growing. I'm sure you all know there's been a steady assault on the labor movement since the Reagan administration, and it's taken a terrible toll. But my union is organizing workers in the Deep South and in Texas, and we're winning through collective bargaining contracts that protect not only against discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation, but also gender identity and gender expression. So in places like Georgia and Louisiana and Texas, my union is winning those kinds of protections that the local jurisdictions are not likely to enact anytime soon.
Next question makes mention that you had said in Berkeley that you thought of the AIDS quilt because you were trying to think of something your grandmother could be a part of while you supported ACT UP. This seems really important now in opposing the current president. Could you comment?
That's a very good question. So when ACT UP and the quilt started the same year, and I certainly supported ACT UP, I owe my life to ACT UP's work and the treatment action group that evolved out of ACT UP. But ACT UP was a bit of a clique. It was overwhelmingly white men between 25 and 35, college educated. There was a dress code of Doc Martens and black leather bomber jackets, and I just couldn't see Nana in a black leather jacket, you know, shutting down Wall Street. But my grandmothers loved me deeply, and I was the firstborn grandchild, so I was special. And you know, they've been gone for a long time now, but I still think of both of them every day. And I believe that had they been given the opportunity, both of them would have gladly given their own lives to save mine or any other of their grandchildren. I believe that. And I wanted to make a place for them in the movement. So I thought, when I had the idea of the quilt, I was obsessed with it for a whole year, and everybody told me it was the stupidest thing they'd ever heard of. Oh, that won't work, that won't work. And you know, the chorus that emerges anytime you want to do anything, to tell you all the reasons why you're stupid and it won't work. But it did. And now, currently, you know, whether we're talking about the young workers in tech, in the tech industry, whose presence in our city has transformed the city in a way that for many of us is quite frightening, or whether we're talking about the majority of white women in this country who voted for Trump, we need to find that patience and respect and vocabulary. And it requires a lot of patience and a lot of tongue biting. But I hear so often, especially from younger people on the progressive side, saying things like, well, it's not my job to educate you on this. Excuse me, it is your job. And that means listening, because you might be talking to somebody who you know in your heart is a racist. But the minute you say to them, you're a racist, that stops the conversation. There's a young woman that's a very effective organizer in my union named Kelly Dugan, and she gets some of the most difficult assignment. Right now she's organizing the workers in the tribal casinos in the Central Valley. And after the Women's March, there were a number of critiques that immediately went up. Like within a few hours, people were criticizing the Women's Marches. And she posted that, you know, she's never been involved with a significant campaign that did not require her to listen to and attempt to communicate with people who absolutely were racist, misogynist, homophobic, Republican, anti-union, you know, that whole thing. But that's what it's all about, is changing hearts and minds and persuading people. Only one person in my whole extended family voted for Trump. That's my sister's husband's father. And he voted for Trump. But I've always been welcome in his home. And he now has grandchildren who are of color. And he loves them. And he voted for Trump. So I'm not going to scream at him and tell him he's a homophobe or a racist. I'm going to continue to engage with him. And I think all of us are called upon to do that.
Thank you, Gleave. I think those are wise words.
Thank you.
On that note, I'm reminded of the last two stanzas of Cesar Chavez's Prayer for the Farm Worker, in which he says, "Let us remember those who have died for justice, for they have given us life. Help us to remember, even help us to love even those who hate us, so we can change the world."
Yeah. It's a scary time right now as we see the center collapsing and people moving. And it's not just happening here, it's happening in the UK. people are moving, and you know, the leftist in me is heartened to see so much of the movement to the left, but I'm also frightened to when I see that center disappearing. And we can all be part of that. That's not something we should leave to activists or our elected officials. We should all engage in that ourselves with our own families and our own networks.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
And our guest is human rights activist Cleave Jones. I'm Mark Leno, your moderator. So, on to our next question. One of our guests tonight asks, so many LGBT people are self-segregating. How can we come together? We need to fight for all. I think that's a lot about your work.
Boy, isn't it
Unite
true?
Here.
Isn't it true? It's so strange that such a small community would want to divide itself into ever smaller fragments. One of the most disheartening things I have experienced recently in recent years was during the National Equality March that you referenced, which was in October of 2009, and I was in D.C. I got there a few days early, and I was with a whole crew of the younger organizers that had really done all the work to make that thing happen, and we were a very diverse collection. of people in terms of race and gender and location, you know, from all across the country. And we went to this bar. I can't remember the name of the bar, but at the time it was the most popular gay bar in Washington, D.C., and everybody was going there, and it was a Friday night. And it was a two-story building, and there, you walk in the door, and there's a lobby, and then there's stairs going up to the second floor, or you could turn left and go into the ground floor. And as we walked in, the white people went upstairs, and the black people turned left. Nobody was requiring it. Nobody was pointing them that way. It was voluntary segregation. More and more, I feel like I just want to yell at people. You know, if your capacity for empathy, your ability to form friendships and interact with people is limited or defined by your skin color, your ethnicity, or gender, or generation, we're really in trouble. And I hear sometimes I hear people saying, "Well, you know, I just don't have the patience for it." I think what you don't want to be exposed to all these other kinds of experiences. For me, I always craved that, you know, to meet and connect and interact with people whose life experience was different than my own. But it's a very troubling reality. And if nothing else, I hope Trump will wake people up to the urgent need for unity.
It is a quandary, and I know that we've had some protests outside some of our local clubs where door people are double and triple carding certain members of our community as if to discourage them from coming in, which is so distressing. But then, and I'm not out at the clubs as much as I used to, I don't know why that is, but every once in a while I will be in a room full of people celebrating, and it is the most beautiful rainbow collection of folks. And there's nothing more thrilling. And I have to wonder, why is this not more the norm? And why is it the exception? I don't know what that is about.
Our greatest strength is our greatest challenge. And that's that we come in so many different sizes, shapes, colors, and backgrounds. What you got?
We have two questions about Gilbert's flag.
Oh, I miss Gilbert.
And discussion about changing the colors, like what they did in Philadelphia. Thoughts?
Gilbert himself revised the flag constantly. Gilbert created rainbow versions of all 50 state flags, and I don't know how many territories there are, but he did them for all of them, too. He did a collection of national flags. He subtracted colors and added colors. So, you know, he meant he had no intention of enforcing any kind of way, but he appreciated it when changes were made that were aesthetically pleasing.
To Gilbert.
Yes. And so I personally thought the Philadelphia flag, I just thought it looked clunky. And then I posted on Facebook a couple of variations that center people of color that I thought were beautiful. And one in particular, if you want to see it, it's on my Facebook page. And it's a fist that has sort of the spectrum of skin tones on it, juxtaposed in a circle over the spectrum of light. So I felt like that version really respected what, you know, Gilbert's original design, but made the point of focusing on people of color in the stretch. There it is. Hold that up. It's very cool. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that is a great image. And
yeah,
the thought that the flag should continue to evolve and that it is a work in progress and it is an art project that is never finished, that seems to fit my memory of Gilbert so well.
Yeah.
And so aesthetically pleasing or not, I think in his heart, he would like to see it be recreated on a regular basis. And as you mentioned, Cleve, he started with 8 for facilitation and maybe even commercial purposes. It got reduced to 6. and then it's been seven, and I like the idea as well. That it should
continue. I told him to copyright it, but he said no, it was his gift to the world, and now yeah. You see those, you know, it's ubiquitous, and there's rainbow tchotchkes for sale everywhere, and he never made a penny off of any of it, so.
You know, imagine, and we discussed this and made note of it at the Castro Theater a few weeks ago when we had a memorial gathering for Gilbert, that this fellow in his creativity came up with an image, simple, taken from nature, pulled from the sky, but because it fit such a profound need, this image we've now seen projected on the White House, on the Eiffel Tower, the top of One World Trade Center, European capitals. Isn't this astounding? One idea around the world. And it's only since the memorial where I'm more conscious every time I see the rainbow flag somewhere, because it's become so ubiquitous that you almost take it for granted. You don't even see it. I'm being very conscious now whenever I see it. I'm saying a little prayer for Gilbert.
I keep reaching for the phone to call him. It was so great to have him here the week that When We Rise premiered. You know, we showed it, the whole thing at the Castro without commercials, thankfully. And Gilbert and I sat in the very back row with a big bag of popcorn and a big box of chocolates and laughed and cried and made fun of Dustin Lance Black while we watched the whole thing. But, you know, over the years, there would be images that one of us would see and we would immediately email to the other. And I remember there were riots in Istanbul and there was this brutal crackdown by the Turkish police. And there was this amazing image of these barricades and smoke and tear gas and people running and this young kid climbing up on top of the barricade and waving this rainbow flag, and the first displays in China, the rainbow flag being carried through Kiev, and while the right-wing nationalists were throwing rocks and acid at the marchers, just it meant so much to him, and I think it's just such a remarkable example of how one person can have one idea that can go out and touch the lives of literally hundreds of millions of people. And he was a mad queen, but he really did a good job.
And she knew how to dress. Our next question, Cleve, is asking what you believe is the biggest threat to the progress we've made in civil rights beyond this president, and what we can all do to mitigate that threat.
Well, whoever asked that, are you specific to LGBTQ? Yes.
I think so.
Okay, so there's the obvious reality that Trump and the Republicans are going to try to roll back stuff that we have to defend. I think we all understand that. But there's another threat that isn't being talked about, and if and when you become mayor, it's going to be something I'm going to be, you know, yelling at you a lot about. So much of what we've achieved in the LGBT community, or LGBTQIAI, whatever it is now, has to do with our neighborhoods. And wherever you look, really, I think this is true all around the world, but especially in our country and in Canada, the gayborhoods, if you will, grew up in marginal neighborhoods. The Castro, the Polk, well, here at first it was Polk. The Polk Gulch was, you know, the population of San Francisco was declining steadily after the end of World War II. The population was declining every year. White middle-class people were leaving all of the inner cities, the phenomenon called white flight that was very strong in the 60s and 70s. So these areas that had been light industry, maybe like south of Market, or just kind of blighted, like the Haight-Ashbury, this is where gay bars were allowed to open. And then gay people began to live there. And Valencia Street, you know, when I was young, was full of lesbian businesses and coffee shops. And again, it was affordable. Now the gayborhoods are going away. And they're going away at a time when we may need them more than ever. And then when I try to talk to people about this, especially millennials, they say, oh, well, Cleve, you know, cities change. Well, duh. You know, yes, of course, cities change. And we need to pay attention to that change and the ramifications of that change. So if we lose the gayborhoods, and the Castro where I live now in a rent-controlled unit is becoming less gay with every month that passes. Now, I don't have an issue with heterosexual people raising their families in my neighborhood. I like kids. But we need to pay attention to this because people say, well, it's because we're more accepted. No. You know, don't think that. Don't think you can live anywhere in this country and be safe and be out. Because if you think that, you're deluded. You know, there's neighborhoods in this city where you would not be safe walking hand in hand with your partner. Or they say, well, we don't need gay bars anymore because we've got technology. Okay, yeah, I get that. But the reality is if we lose the gayborhoods, we lose the political power that comes when you're concentrated in specific precincts that allows you to elect people like Harvey Milk and Mark Leno. It allows you to defeat legislation that is harmful to you and enact legislation that you benefits your community. We also lose the cultural vitality. Look at all the stuff that came out of the Castro, the rainbow flag, the first marching band, the first synagogue, the first film festival. All of these things happen when creatives, when the choreographers and the poets and the filmmakers and the novelists and the dancers inhabit the same space and can make eye contact. And I know collaboration happens online, but there's nothing like that amazing energy that happens when these folks are inhabiting the same space. And then also we lose the specialized social services that are so important, especially to our most vulnerable. People that are HIV positive, our youth, our senior citizens, our transgender neighbors. I live in a rent-controlled unit in the Castro. I only rented it 7 years ago, so I'm paying a lot of money for rent, but it is still below market for sure. And I think, you know, I'm a white, educated man living in this society. I'm also quite connected and quite able to advocate for myself. But, you know, when my inevitable eviction happens, I don't know where I'm going. I can't afford to pay $4,000 a month for a studio apartment. I can't afford to buy here. I make enough money that I don't qualify for any kind of subsidized housing. So I'm going to have to leave the city. When I get evicted, I'm going to have to leave the city. Where do I go and who's going to take care of me? And for my generation of gay men, you know, the reality for me and most of my brothers is that we came of age during a time when many of us did not retain the affection and support of our biological families. Many of us did not feel that having children was an option in our life. It's wonderful for me to see so many gay and lesbian couples having children. I love that. I regret that I didn't have kids myself. And then during that time when we should have been saving money and investing properly and looking after our finances, we were on the front line of a war. You know, people forget it was a whole decade, a decade and a half of misery and death before effective treatments became available. And during that time, most of us lost the people we loved the most. So I feel that my friends and I, my peers, are very, very vulnerable. And if we're dispersed outward, I don't know who's going to take care of us. So I want you and all of our leaders, but it's not just the leaders who need to be talking about this. If these neighborhoods are going away, look what's happened to the black community in this town. It was, you know, 16, 17% African-American in this city when I moved here. And now, you know what, it's 3%, and it's probably dropped while we've been talking. There used to be a Filipino community in this town, all dispersed. So it's not about just saying, oh, cities change. And it's not about saying, you know, we don't need gay bars maybe anymore. It's about really thinking carefully about how do we protect what we need to keep our lives going and moving forward.
You are right. So much of our community is vulnerable and will become ever more so as we age, as is every community as it ages. The challenges facing the later years are many and complex. I want to just give a shout out to our dear friend Marcy Edelman and her partner, no longer with us, Jeanette Gurevich. If you're not familiar with their names, both therapists, and they got in their head, and Marcy's expertise was in gerontology and specific to the queer community. And she was onto this as a student in the mid and late 70s. And any kind of academic interest waned, of course, when we found ourselves in the middle of the epidemic. Who was going to even live to old age? We didn't have time, we didn't have the luxury to discuss such issues. But this has been a passion for Marcy and for Jeanette through her life. And I was on the board of supervisors in the late 90s, and they came to me as a supervisor. We want to build senior housing for gay seniors. Can you help? Again, these are not-for-profit developers who know how to build affordable housing. These are two therapists, but so passionate about their interest. I happened to get a call from Art Agnos around that same time, who was suggesting as a friend to me as a new supervisor, Leno, I've got a great issue for you. I started on it, but it's got a long ways to go. And it just was a coincidence of occurrence that I got these knocks on my doors from these two different entities. So, of course, it was just natural to introduce Marcy and Jeanette to Art, who is then the regional director for housing and urban development in the later years of the Clinton administration. And fast forward 17 years, and we have now something called Open House out of this crazy little wacky idea that these two Jewish therapists had. We now have affordable housing for LGBT seniors. We need a whole lot more, but just the power of an idea and the commitment to it really can change the world. The next questionnaire mentions that a favorite line in your book is where you stated that you were a proud queen. Can you tell that story and talk more about what you meant?
Well, I don't recall that line.
But you are Blanche.
But I am.
You are.
You know, one of the things Gilbert Baker and I had in common was that I think we both struggled so hard to fit in when we were kids and in high school, and it was such a relief to give that up. And I don't want to fit in. I want to be able to be myself, and I think that was what we always wanted from the beginning. You know, was for everybody to be able to speak and walk and dance and dress and move and love as the way that feels natural to them. But it goes a little bit deeper than that. And I paraphrase Harry Hay, I think, poorly in my book. But Harry Hay was one of the founders of the Mattachine Society, one of the very first organizations for gay people in this country, along with the Daughters of Bilitis. And he was quite a radical, and later would go on to start the Radical Fairies. And he said something close to, there's a lot of gay people who say that we're just like straight people except for what we do in bed. And then there's some of us who say that what we do in bed really isn't that different from what straight people do, but we're different in every other way. And this is a debate that every generation has engaged in since the 50s, and each generation has its own vocabulary, which is usually pretty annoying to the preceding generation. But we've all had this conversation, and it really did begin in the 50s, and the Mattachine Society actually fell apart over this question of, are we a queer and distinct people with revolutionary potential, or are we just like everybody else? And the 20-somethings now are having this very same conversation using a whole different vocabulary, but it kind of gets to this kind of existential question that all of us sort of have and address. And you know, you don't have to have a rigid position that's all... I kind of go back and forth, but that's where my roots are, and yes, I'm a proud queen.
If you've seen any of those photographs of Harry and the Mattachine folks protesting at the White House on the 4th of July specifically, mm-hmm. to make the point that they were second-class citizens, as everyone celebrates the founding of this great democracy, that it wasn't all it was cracked up to be. And the leaders of Mattachine insisted that all the men wear button-down shirts and had their narrow ties and sport coats on to look like...
And the women had to wear skirts.
The women did wear skirts, and to look as though they fit in. They weren't looking to cause the revolution. What was on their signs was revolutionary enough, because it was outrageous that a queer person would even show his or her face in public during the day under the sunlight, much less demand equal treatment under the law. That was revolutionary. They didn't want to exacerbate the situation by looking revolutionary. But then that all changed, of course, as we approached Stonewall and here with Compton's Cafe's riot in 67, where a very different group of people said, we've had enough, and we're going to express this in every and any way. And so I refer to this as capital drag, remembering that RuPaul once said, we're born naked, the rest is drag. And there's such wisdom in that line because, number one, it's true, and number two, choose your drag, whatever it may be. That's the celebration. And no one should be denied whatever his or her choice is. So open the closet doors, have your pick, and enjoy it. That's what the revolution's about.
And Mark, you rock the black leather pants.
So as I will be in them at the parade on Sunday, backed by popular demand, I wouldn't be right without them in any case. I like this next question. If you had the chance to tell Harvey one thing today, what might it be?
Just, you know, oh my goodness, you have no idea. He was the first adult to tell me I was fine just the way I was. And, you know, he was the most genuinely empathetic political person I've ever met in my life. He just loved people. You know, it was very genuine, and he loved this city. He predicted his assassination, which is something that I still, you know, think about regularly. But I just think he would be so amazed at how far we've come. And after he died, you know, there was this group of us that decided we would do whatever we could to keep his memory alive. And some of them got the statue installed at City Hall, named the subway stop after him, the school, and all of that. But I'll tell you, his name was disappearing, and I was traveling a lot in the 90s and early 2000s, and I'd go to big liberal arts universities and, you know, large audiences, and I'd say, how many of you know who Harvey Milk was? You know, there'd be one or two hands up. Like, he was disappearing, and he understood the power of popular culture and the media. And I think that what Dustin Lance Black and Gus Van Sant did with that film is an example of just how powerful popular culture can be. And I think he would be intrigued by that. You know, my personal belief system does not include heaven or hell, but I kind of like to suspend my disbelief to imagine Harvey up there just, you know, grinning and laughing and being happy that his story was known for so many. And I would love to be able to tell him, you know, someday hundreds of millions of people will know who you were.
I think there's been a relighting of his memory as of late, because you're right, and it takes effort to keep a flame lit, because generations do come and go, and if we don't teach and the next generation doesn't learn, it goes.
Or they revise it.
Yeah, and I credit Equality California for suggesting a bill that we did to create Harvey Milk Day in California, which is on May 22nd every year. It's called a day of special significance. So we don't give state workers a day off. There's no money in the budget to pay for an extra holiday, but it is a day of special significance, and the governor declares it to be, by statute, mm-hmm. Harvey Milk Day every May 22nd. And I saw the power of that very clearly. For years in Sacramento, we've had something called Queer Youth Advocacy Day. And high school and even middle school kids get on a bus and come to Sacramento. They get a little training in how to lobby a legislator. So this is a first novel experience for so many of these young people. And so they get a day's training, then they go into the legislative offices and they make their case for one or two or three bills that are before the legislature regarding LGBT civil rights. And I met a 16, 17-year-old girl who identified as lesbian. And I was talking to her after the second day, and she was just ecstatic, and you could see it in her face. And she said her life had been changed by the experience of queer youth advocacy, and I asked her to explain it a bit more, and that she said when she arrived that Sunday evening, she had never heard of Harvey Milk. And she, of course, came to learn of Harvey Milk as she went through her training, and then had the experience of advocating for a particular civil rights bill in a legislative office. And I said, well, that sounds very powerful, but how has that life changed? And she said, before hearing about Harvey Milk's story, that she imagined her own life had only one possibility, and that was to be like her mother, who was the only other lesbian she knew. And her mother was addicted to drugs, and her life was spiraling out of control, and she didn't think she had an option. Just the simple fact of hearing about what Harvey did, she realized she had no boundaries. She could aspire to anything. Mm-hmm. And that certainly gave me a thrill as we fought to get that bill signed into law. It took a while because that governor vetoed it once and we had to come back a second time. But once Harvey had box office success, thanks to Gus and Lance and Cleve, if there's one thing that governor understood, it was box office. And he signed the bill into law. What advice do you have, Cleve, for the younger generation to continue the fight for civil rights?
Well, I think that's the perfect question with which to end this evening. And I'll respond not only to the younger generation, but to everybody. We have entered a critical period in our history, and a great deal hangs in the balance. I think it would be difficult actually to overstate what a dangerous time this is right now. And it's particularly dangerous for LGBTQ people. It's dangerous for people who care about the health of the planet, who care about equality, public education, clean water, anything you want to care about, you better be paying attention. So there's a lot of people out there that, there's a lot of forces out there that would like you to believe that you're powerless, that your voices cannot be heard, that what you do doesn't matter. And those are lies. Everything you do matters. The decisions you make matter. The choices you make matter. And every one of you can play a role, regardless of your age or background or education or any other factor. Every one of you has something you can offer to this struggle. Those of you who have gray hair like me, and we will probably not live long enough to see the damage of this last election undone. And those of you who are young, I think we're going to be fighting this battle for most of the rest of your lives. Movements are never won. They continue, and advances must be defended, and reversals must be addressed. So my advice is to find a way to contribute that brings you joy, that makes your heart glad. Don't be one of those people that's wagging your finger and saying, you know. Help raise people up by raising yourself up and loving what you do. People thank me a lot for my work. You don't need to thank me. I'm a very selfish person. I'm a selfish queen. I do this work because I absolutely love it. I don't have any hobbies. I don't want to retire. I don't golf. What would I do? I hope to drop dead on a picket line somewhere. But I'm serious. I'm serious. I love the work. So every one of you, look inside your own selves and see what skills you have that you can bring to this. But it's important for you to enjoy it, because only then will you be able to sustain that effort. And I think one of the greatest qualities that is rarely mentioned when people talk about what it takes to really make a difference in this world is endurance. And that's how I began this, by telling, you know, there were so many times in my life when I thought it was over. And it wasn't. And it really was the movement that saved my life and moved me forward. And every one of you can have that same experience. And remember that people like Harvey Milk and Nelson Mandela and Rosa Parks and Cesar Chavez were ordinary people. You know, what they did, all of you can aspire to do as well. So find a way to contribute. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Or as Margaret Mead said, never doubt that a small group of committed and focused people can change the world. In fact, it is only they who ever have. So,
thank you.
One more time, our thanks to Cleve Jones.
Thank you. Thank you, Mark. Thank you. Thank you, and I want to thank the Commonwealth Club very much for having
me.
Thank you.
Yes, we do thank the Commonwealth Club, not just for tonight, but your entire series of these kinds of panels and all the speakers that you bring to life in San Francisco. We are very fortunate to have our Commonwealth Club. And we also thank our audiences here and on radio and television and the Internet. Tonight's program has been a part of the club's Good Lit series. I suspect that's in reference to your book, Cleve, Good Lit, sponsored by the Bernard Osher Foundation. And we want to remind everyone again, as was mentioned at the beginning of the evening, that there are signed copies of Cleve's book, and they are for sale following the program. I'm Mark Leno, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.